What I'd like to share with you today are some ideas, some stories. I have no hard and fast recipes or proven answers. I have some things that have worked in my experience, and I've seen them work in other situations as well. Mostly what I want to do this morning is try to engage you on a kind of conceptual or imaginative level. We'll talk about some of the nuts and bolts and how to actually wire some of this stuff together in the workshops this morning and this afternoon. But I like to start at the idea level or even at the storytelling level because I think it's very easy to get distracted by all of the machinery, all of the applications, all of this endless tech churn, Twitter or Smitter or Splitter or what was it and hashtag and what did he mean by that and so forth. Those are important to master eventually. But just as you would get discouraged if you had to learn the alphabet without ever actually being able to read, can you imagine that? That wouldn't be any fun. I think also without the idea level or the storytelling level, the technology is not really going to be very meaningful or useful. So I want to start there. And I want to start with a story. This one actually stars a portrait of me, so it's very near and dear to my heart. But I didn't do that portrait. That portrait is about a week old now, and it was done by this fellow, Marco Torres. As you can see from the caption, he teaches high school, he's an education technology director, he's an Apple Distinguished Educator. This really only scratches the surface of his capabilities. He's a musician, he's a filmmaker, he's an artist. He's someone who works in education with high school students in highly disadvantaged areas, to use these new media to offer them opportunities for creativity, hands-on project and challenge-driven learning, not too different from what we would want students to be able to experience in a general education curriculum. And he's found this very freeing. He's found that it actually energizes students who have become completely disenfranchised, disenchanted, discouraged by schooling. It actually restores them to the life of the mind. I was sitting at a restaurant in Saratoga, California, with Marco Torres, who is a board member, a fellow board member on the New Media Consortium. And Marco was sitting here. I was sitting here. Marco had his iPhone out. Now, let me hasten to add, this is not a commercial for the iPhone. It's doing quite well without my advertising. The latest estimate is something like $15 billion market for apps in 2 years, over 100,000 apps available now. This is just the beginning. So Marco's there with his iPhone, right? I'm sitting here enjoying a perfectly lovely meal, and he's doing my portrait. I had no idea he was doing that. He might have been checking his email. That's usually what you think people are doing if they're bent over a handheld device, but he wasn't. He was doing my portrait, and he was doing it on this mobile computer. An iPhone is a mobile computer. It happens to have telephony built in. But it's a mobile computer. Make no mistake. It's the future that we're looking at. And I was amazed. So I said, Marco, may I have a copy? So he emailed me a copy to my Gmail account, which was the most efficient way of transferring it from his phone to my phone at that moment. I then sent the picture to my daughter in Waco, Texas, because she's an artist, and I knew she would find this intriguing. Plus, it's her daddy, and her daddy's away from home, and her daddy misses her. And here I am, and I'm thinking of you, and I love you. And look at this very cool thing that this person sitting next to me just did. I sent her a text message with the photo attached. She texted back, whoa, everyone here just freaked out. She was at her friend's house, and immediately showed the photo face-to-face via this electronic mediation all the way from California to Texas, originating from a guy sitting next to me doing the portrait while we're eating dinner. So she shows it to her friends. And you're following the connections here, right? They're face-to-face. They're electronic. They're over a wireless network. They're on a mobile computer. They involve art. They involve a human being. A human being who matters, I think, some to Marco Torres. Matters a lot, I think, to his daughter, Jenny. She shares it with her friends. And I write back, because I asked Marco, having shared the text message with him at that moment, because I knew he would like that. I said, yep, Marco told me, three apps, Photogene, Toon Paint, and brushes, on top of the photo he had taken of me as I was sitting there. Now, ordinarily, we would say, he took a photo of you sitting there, you didn't know it, that's invading your privacy. Well, it was, but I trusted him. That's important. And who knew what he was going to do with it? Well, that's what he did with it. He used Photogene, cost $2. This is Toon Paint, which costs $2. And that's brushes, which costs, I think, $2, maybe $3. Maybe some of you read in the New York Times about David Hockney, one of the most important artists of the 20th and 21st century, using brushes on his iPhone every morning to essentially paint three original works, which he then emails to his friends. That would be a nice email list to be on. His paintings sell for millions of dollars, and he just makes these little paintings on his iPhone and sends them around. He's been asked, how does that compare to the painting on canvas that you usually do? He says it's a different experience. It's like stained glass. On the iPhone, the light shines through it instead of shining on it, which is interesting. So David Hockney, Marco Torres, Gardner Campbell, Jenny Campbell, California, Waco, Texas, she's with her friends, text messaging. All that adds up to that. Now, I would say this matters a great deal. It took about 15 minutes or less for that whole exchange to happen, including the time it took for Marco to make the portrait. It had a great deal to do with creativity, with the integration of various modes of thinking, the analytical, the creative. It was social. It was intensely individual, as art is. It set up a network of resonances mediated by these information and communication technologies. And it was spontaneous. It just happened. But the fact that it just happened was not the whole story. I want to encourage you today to think about that little story about a father and his daughter and a guy sitting next to the father at a restaurant as one small example of the way in which these technologies that can clutter our lives, that can be very distracting, that can have all sorts of unintended consequences, including traffic accidents as people are doing their brushes, Toon Paint, Photogene, while they're driving on the interstate, etc. That's an extreme example, but texting we know and talking on the phone, we know about these things. There are many, many unintended consequences that come as a result of these technologies. But some of them are intended, and some of the intentions we can bring to bear with these technologies are spectacular for what they afford us in terms of creativity and thought and analysis and what may in fact be some ways of thinking that are new, that are emerging. Just for a sense of scale, how many of you have heard of Moore's Law? Any computer scientists say, yeah, okay, good. Well, I'm going to tell you what I believe Moore's Law to be, and I will stand under correction, okay, speak under correction. Roughly every 18 months, sometimes it was reported 2 years, but the Wikipedia article tells us, no, that's actually not what it was. Every 18 months, the power of the CPU in a computer, the central processing unit, will double, and the price will fall by about half. Is that close for you Moore's Law people? Okay, good. That's an exponential scaling effect that has happened. This has held true for about 4 decades now. We believe there are going to be limits in the next decade or so, but we've heard that before. Quantum computing holds out the promise that Moore's Law will actually extend towards the end of this century. What that means is that we're in a very interesting scaling moment in which the power and the relative low cost of these tools begins to enable something that just 10 years ago would have sounded very much like science fiction. The central processing unit in the iPhone and in the iPad is the Cortex A8, or Apple's version thereof, at least as far as we can tell, right? Apple's notoriously secretive about that. I love the fact that the CPU is called a Cortex. There's obviously an inside joke there. That's a previous generation. This is the next generation. It's already in production. It probably takes up too much power for the iPhone or the iPad, but that will get worked on as well. It's the Cortex A9. Just to give you an idea of what we're looking at here, there are four separate units in that chip, which is about the size of your thumbnail, four separate units for processing four independent streams of high definition audio and video. So it's the equivalent of four Blu-ray players and four Blu-ray recorders on a chip the size of your thumbnail. And that's just the graphical processing unit. There are four independent parallel processors in there. This is leading in places that we're not really able to predict very well. But it looks like, within a couple of years, in addition to carrying high-definition encoding and decoding times four in your pocket, consuming less than 1 watt, and it won't burn your leg, which is the definition of a millicomputer, we'll have about 10 times today's web surfing speed, a 20-megapixel camera, 130 hours of audio playback on a mobile device. This is from a presentation on IT Conversations by a fellow named Adrian Cockcroft, who has a blog called Millicomputing. If you want to see what's coming around the bend, that's a good blog to read. When Cockcroft fleshes this idea out, it takes him into some interesting places. Within about 5 years, you may be able to walk into an office environment or a classroom and have the device in your pocket, this size, connect wirelessly to all your peripherals, keyboard, outboard display, external hard drives, if we're still using spinning rust then, projectors like that, of course the entire network, of course. In fact, Cockcroft suggests you won't just be connecting wirelessly, you'll actually be running a web server from your pocket. 4 to 5 years. Now, what is that going to mean for education? No longer are we looking at a situation in which we've got to keep kids from texting each other. We're going to have to keep kids from sitting in their seats encoding high-definition movies that they're uploading to YouTube that are going to get millions of views while they're not paying attention to what we're saying. Or maybe we're not going to want them to stop doing that. Maybe simply paying attention to what I'm saying all the time is not going to be the gold standard. Or maybe we have to think about attention in a different way. Now, here I am standing at the front of a room lecturing you about not paying attention to me. Are there ironies here? Of course there are ironies here. There are also possibilities for some emergent hybrid forms, I think, of attention, creation, response. This is just one particular example. Because this is what we're looking at. And if we in higher education can't come to terms with this, then who is going to? I would rather us grasp this nettle than simply a handful of corporations. We're the folks who ought to be able not only to think about this, but to help other people think about this. Because I believe this is true. We are living in the middle of the largest increase in expressive capability in the history of the human race. Now, once I presented this to a group of faculty, and a person raised his hand and said, but what if most of the expressive stuff that's out there is junk? To which I said, most of the expressive stuff that's out there already is junk. I actually brought the American Way from my flight. It's mildly entertaining. It's mostly junk. It's mostly ads and this kind of interesting feature where people who work in offices in Austin, Texas, dress up as rock stars and pose in nightclubs so that their fantasy life, if they weren't in an office, can be judged and then displayed. And okay, that's fine, right? It's not Paradise Lost, except maybe metaphorically. But if you want to celebrate print and say there's value in reading, I agree with you. But most of this stuff is already junk. The task is, how do we find the stuff that's not junk? And how do we help our students create stuff that's not junk? And I think that's interesting, especially if we're living in the middle of the largest increase in expressive capability in the history of the human race. It's usually compared to the advent of printing, but I don't think that comparison gets to the scale of what we're experiencing. And let me just suggest for a moment, this is already pretty much off the charts. This is a Gutenberg Bible. This led to assassinations. This led to regicide. This led to massive confusion. This led to scholars grumbling. Within a century or so of the printing press being invented, people are already saying, there's no way you can keep up with all of this. My head is spinning. Who has time for all of these books? It's the death of learning. Maybe it was. Who knows? Within 50 years of the printing press being invented, 20 million books had been printed. Who has time for all of that? Isn't that information overload? Yeah, 4 centuries ago. Now look where we are. I assume you have a library here, right? You may not feel... Uh-oh. Share it with the class, please. What? Remember, my ears are stopped up. Go.
No, I just wanted to reassure you that we have...
Good. Good. It's not all cafes and chaise lounges. Okay, good. 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 You may not go into the library and experience vertigo. Your students might, assuming they go in. But you'll feel vertigo when you go online, and most of your students won't. There's something interesting there. But look, this was a massive disruption in civilization. It was a pivotal moment. We're looking at something on the scale of this, which was the emergence of the phonetic alphabet. When I really want to wind my students up, I will say, that's a technology. It's a technology Socrates was very skeptical about. It's a technology to communicate with the dead, among other things. That's what we're looking at. This largest increase in expressive capability is on this scale. What will you do with an alphabet? That's a hard question to answer. The answer, one answer is, what do you want to do? You will write with it. Well, what will I write? What do you want me to write, Dr. Campbell? What are you looking for on this paper, Dr. Campbell? You see how easily it becomes co-opted by our own processes, but it doesn't have to be that way, and it shouldn't be. So here's the question that really keeps me awake at night. It's a question that Janet Murray, another English professor, asks in her introduction to the New Media Reader, which I think in many respects is a gen ed textbook for the kind of media fluency I'm describing. Murray asks, how long will it take before we see the gift for what it is, a single new medium of representation, the digital medium formed by the braided interplay of technical invention and cultural expression at the end of the 20th century? And I don't know the answer to that question. In some ways, it's the question of, do you get it? Although that sounds so clubby and inside and exclusive, it's not a good question. But the question of, when will we recognize the gift for what it is? Not just kids misbehaving, but something that really is a new language, is an interesting question. There are things that block that recognition, and they're not all things that are bad. Some of them are sensible cautions. There's a picture of a gift. Anybody recognize that young woman? It's Pandora, whose name means all gifts. Yes. Which doesn't make sense, right? All the gifts escaped because of Pandora, except for one that was left. So did she unleash a host of ills on the world? Maybe. Did she preserve hope for the world? Maybe. Was she prying into things better not pried into? Maybe. Anybody recognize this young woman? We have these deep-rooted fears. Some things are better left uneaten. Some gifts are better left unrecognized. But just to show that this is not gender-specific, some of you may recognize this very buff young man. Can you see the image? It is, in fact, Prometheus. All right? So there he is with the vulture liver thing happening. Not a very pretty sight. Because he, too, was interested in technology. And if you think it was a bad thing, and you're living in Chicagoland with the winters that you have here, move to Texas. Although we had 4 inches of snow this time in Waco. It was a record. Everybody was just frantic. 4 inches of snow. What'll we do? Here's another technologist and his proud father, in this instant, losing some of his pride, or maybe wondering whether he should have invented wings at all. You know who that is? Right? Icarus and his daddy Daedalus. And there's Icarus because he flew too close to the sun. The technology made him ambitious. Well, there are a couple of lessons you can take from that. One is, don't try to fly so high. Keep your ambitions modest. That's the one I like. That was actually Stanley Kubrick's line, too, so you're in very good company. Stanley Kubrick, the great filmmaker, said he always thought the myth of Icarus had a very clear moral, which is use better wax, make better wings, which I have to agree with. But if you're in the business of keeping people's ambitions moderated, if you're in the business of telling them not to fly so high, you're probably not in the education business. That's not what we do. There's enough stuff in the world that'll say, oh, don't try for so much. Don't dream so much. Don't overtax your powers. But educators, that's not really in our DNA. Or maybe, to descend to a much more recent example, maybe we're all just kind of hoping it's like hula hoops and it'll just go away. Like Elvis, who did go away. I believe Elvis did die. It's an article of faith with me. I've actually seen his gravesite twice. I've been to Graceland twice. So now you know what you're up against. A lot of the stuff we look at with our iPhones, with our computers, with our text messaging, with what our kids are doing on whatever they're doing now, can look trivial, like popular culture, which is not a bad thing in my book, but can look very superficial. Sometimes it is, but sometimes not. And I'm here to say that it's not going to go away. These information and communication technologies, this revolution we're living through, is just getting started. It's not going to go away. You can block wireless. You can have people turn off their laptops. And sometimes maybe you should. You can do whatever you think you need to do to try to put the genie back in the bottle, but it's not going to happen. It just isn't. So, like the alphabet, like print, which was also a threat when it first came out, people running around with their own Bibles, what's that about? There was a fear. You'll take it into the pubs and mock the naughty bits, which, of course, people did. Nobody's going to confiscate them now. They're not hula hoops. It really isn't going to go away. So, that's the gift and why it may be hard to come to grips with. This is something about technology, to ask you to think about what that is. This is a book I read last year. I recommend it very highly to you. It's called The Nature of Technology by W. Brian Arthur. He's trying to come up with essentially a theory of technology. And to do that, he actually has to define technology, which it turns out is not an easy thing to do. We think we know what technology is. Of course, technology is that. That's technology. So how are you going to use technology? That's what we're talking about using. Or it's the Miele computer in my pocket. Or it's the computer that's recording my presentation right now. Or whatever. Or it's that. It's something that happens online. Or technology. That's like Facebook, right? Well, Arthur says that technology is anything we make to serve a human purpose. And he goes on to say that technology is in the particular place of harnessing a naturally occurring phenomenon to make it more powerful or effective. So, by that reasoning, the wind is a naturally occurring phenomenon. A sail is a technology. Not a laptop, not Facebook. At its core, the technology harnesses a naturally occurring phenomenon and puts it to some human purpose. So by that logic, that is a technology. It's the little red schoolhouse. But it's a technology. And once you go down this path, where are you going to stop? That is a technology. People naturally group together. We're primates. We're social. But to build a room for people to sit in and face a certain direction with certain affordances at the front of the room to display things to the... That's a technology. All right? It's one we've built. So there's technology in this room, but the room is also a technology. That's a technology. It's an old technology. There was a brief period of card catalog nostalgia in the Atlantic Monthly in the early 80s. I'm glad it faded very quickly. I mean, this is how I did my dissertation, right? Going through there and feeling all the nice, lovely, worn, smooth cards. But I'm not sorry that that's gone. If I had had what I have now when I was doing my dissertation, I could have done a lot more research. In fact, I probably would never have finished. That's a technology. University of name here. Now, you can get a custom-made fake diploma, but that's just there to remind us that this, too, is an artificial thing. It is something we've made to harness a naturally occurring phenomenon, but to make it more powerful and effective. And if you have to ask, how does a diploma make a naturally occurring phenomenon, learning, more powerful and effective, then clearly you are not marketing yourselves to your students very well, because this is what they want. They don't want it to be fake, but they want it when they get done with their 4 years. But it's a degree. It's a diploma. It's a technology. This is very near to what we're talking about today. That's a curriculum. That's a technology, too. It organizes and harnesses naturally occurring phenomena, development, learning, right? But it does it in a way that doesn't occur in nature. We make this. It is a technology. What else? The credit hour is a technology. Little over 100 years old. And boy, does it get in the way. Ever tried to do something interdisciplinary? Ever tried to do something with team teaching? Ever tried to think about teaching loads? If you haven't, then you're in another schooling galaxy from all the schools I've been to, because this is the elementary system of accounting. Not just for our students, but for all of us as well, right? FTEs derive from this. Diplomas derive from this. What does it mean? Well, crudely put, it means how long were you sitting down in a room? This breaks when we get to online learning, of course, which causes everybody headaches. It even breaks between sciences and humanities. Ever tried to figure that out? How much are the labs worth here? An extra credit hour? Science is 4 credit hours, humanities 3, or are they on par here? Typically? Okay. So are they sitting down in the lab for an hour? See, already it doesn't make sense. But you have to have it, or else what are you going to do? The system breaks down. Well, okay. What if it breaks down? GPA is a function of credit hours and letter grades. All of those are technologies. They are technologies that matter to our students, often more than learning does. A course is a technology. It does not occur in nature. A semester is a technology. An examination is a technology. A year, what year are you in school, is a technology. A transcript is a technology. And these are all technologies designed to take learning and harness it more powerfully. But now you're starting to get maybe the slight feeling of dread that I'm trying to steer you toward. We think it's tough to have students distracted by their mobile devices. This is what distracts our students. These are the technologies. If any technology can be said to be ruining learning, these are the technologies that cripple what we're trying to do when we try to bring our students into a fuller life of the mind, because they're thinking about credit hours. I ask my students, how many credit hours till graduation? And if they're seniors, they know the answer like that. 122 hours, Dr. Campbell. How many credit hours to get educated? You measure that in credit hours? No. They fix their minds on these things. Learning recedes. In many respects, general education should be preparing them to view these as utilities, as means, not as ends. But it's as if the system of technologies we have set up, and we don't even see anymore, are the ones that distract them from the real reason they're here. And this one I always save till last. Of course, a faculty is a technology as well. I'm sorry to say this, my colleagues, we do not occur naturally. So, yes, we are highly artificial. It may be a good thing. I like to think we're sort of like, you know, I don't know, the Mona Lisa or something, with enigmatic smiles, but I sometimes think maybe not. So, back to computers. What I've tried to do, first of all, is to demystify computers a little bit, demystify technologies of education a lot, and now let me bring you back to where I believe we might be able to go as we think about what these information and communication technologies, these computers, might be able to do to bring us back to a whole view of education or something truly integrative. It won't be automatic. It's not guaranteed. But if we're able to get to the idea level, I think we might have a fighting chance. This is Doug Engelbart. How many of you have heard that name before? This will not be on the exam. I'm just curious. Okay. Doug Engelbart is one of the architects of the information revolution. Janet Murray compares him to Leonardo. I do not think that comparison is far-fetched. You will have to take my word for it for now. Go back and read his, what I would take to be foundational essay, Augmenting Human Intellect, a Conceptual Framework. It came out in 1962 and was the document that led J.C.R. Licklider, who's, if anybody can be called the father of the Internet, I'd say he could be, had led Licklider to fund Engelbart's Augmentation Research Center, which invented interactive computing. And by interactive, I mean that the computer becomes a kind of outboard brain, and because you can interact with it, it actually stimulates what we would call recursion. That is to say, the interaction itself makes something emerge from the pairing that's greater than the sum of the parts. How does that work? For Doug Engelbart, it worked because the computer is a meta-medium. It is a machine built to generate representations. And here's how he described it just a couple of years ago at the 40th anniversary of the invention of the mouse, which is how people usually know Doug Engelbart. But saying he invented the mouse is like saying Leonardo doodled in his notebooks. It's just not quite adequate. So here's what Doug has to say about what he thought computing could be. We're not there yet. But in higher education, we have a better shot than anyone else, it seems to me, at getting to something like this vision.
The biggest thing that was motivating me was the potential, which hasn't really taken off very well, people really think working with their computers, augmenting the human intellect, or boosting the collective IQ with what computers really could do if we learned how to integrate their usage into our own way of thinking. How much change in human society came about when the invention of writing, and then printing and books and so on. Each one made a real stage in the way you learned, the way you did all kinds of exchange and like that. And so what the computer can offer is another step ahead. Look around at this crowd, and you look at somebody, and just instantly, it's a man, it's a woman. So what's the machine millionaire that's doing that? So nobody questions it, but it's really magical there. It says, hey, that's the kind of way in which knowledge content, that we could be absorbing that. And the computer can be so flexible in how it shows you things, emerges things, that why aren't we really working on extending our capability?
Well, that's a little bit to take in all at once. So let me try to amplify it a little bit, clarify it maybe. It's an integrative cognitive process that we experience without even thinking about it. When we say, oh, that's a person. He has a face. Ah, I know what a face is. There's intention. There's agency. This all happens very quickly in our minds, and it's an extremely complex bit of cognition. Engelbart's vision is that the computer would allow us to recognize and communicate concepts with the speed and complexity of the cognition we use when we recognize a face. This is a profoundly integrative moment. And I think it's what we try to get at when we have a general education curriculum. We would like our students to be able to be concept engineers, concept fluent. We'd like our students to be able to share and imagine connections among the various isolated things that they're learning, so that they're not saying biology, chemistry, English, philosophy, religion, PE, language requirement. Instead, they see it the way we would see a face and see an integrity there. Engelbart believed computers could help us get there because of their powers of representation. This is not artificial intelligence. This only happens when the computer is interacting with a human brain. And Douglas Hofstetter, in a book called Fluid Concepts and Creative Analogies, says some very interesting things along these lines. He says that some domain knowledge is necessary to get off the ground, but, quote, I had very deep intuitions to the effect that intelligence has and has to have a powerful, general, and abstract knowledge-independent core. Now, don't get too excited here. Domain knowledge is important, but it's only part of the picture. Hofstetter goes on, perhaps this intuition was just prejudice, but it seemed to me it was grounded. I had known many people who were fountains of knowledge yet seemed to lack all insight. Conversely, I knew of many examples in the history of science where blinding flashes of insight were produced by people who were relative novices to a field, often very young people whose knowledge was incredibly small relative to the wizened experts. So this reliance on lots of expert knowledge instead of on a deeper, more basic, and more abstract type of intelligence was the first aspect of my own work, Hofstetter writes, that I was displeased with. He came up with the idea of generalization. And this leads me to where I'm going to bring the conclusions in. The idea is not so much general education, which begins to look like a nodding acquaintance with a lot of different things, as it is generalizable education. The domain knowledge, but also the generalization ability from this integrative perspective that allows our students to be able to make these kinds of analogies, to be able to create new knowledge, to be able to exercise that aspect of intelligence. And it involves the ability to internally reconfigure an idea. Several ways to do this, and I'm going to go through the bullet points really quickly. You'll have copies of the slides, so don't worry about taking notes on this. I just want to give you a flavor for the idea. Moving internal boundaries back and forth around an idea. Swapping components, shifting substructures from one level to another. Merging two substructures into one or breaking one into two. You can see how this could happen in a biology course, in a history course, in an English course, in a philosophy course. Not at the level of individual facts to be memorized. That's important. But what do you do with that? What can you make of that? How can you represent these kinds of reconfigurations? lengthening or shortening a given component, adding new components or new levels of structure. I taught writing at the freshman level for many, many years. Still do it. I would love for them to think about their sentences this way. Typically, they can't. Typically, they think about their sentences the way the five-paragraph essay taught them not to think about sentences or paragraphs or essays when they were in high school. And you get beginnings like, for millions of years in human history, men and women have always, you know, by that time, it's my face has hit the desk. It's done, right? Because they don't know how to generalize, even at the level of a sentence. Replacing one concept by a closely related one. Or trying out the effect of reversals on various conceptual levels. This is how Hofstetter describes generalizability. Engelbart believed that the computer, because of its flexibility in representing concepts, would be uniquely suited to doing this kind of generalizability. This is a Necker cube. How many of you have seen a Necker cube before? Very elementary trick of the mind. Is the cube coming out facing left or going in facing left? It's like a figure ground reversal, like the face in the vase. Same sort of thing. But this is something that once you're aware of it, you can train your mind to do, to flip perspectives back and forth. This isn't knowledge of a fact. It's knowledge of a cognitive capability. And with practice, something like this becomes important for our students' generalizability. It's something like the music of the spheres, believe it or not.
Hello, in Shakespeare's The Merchant of Venice, the young Lorenzo woos his sweetheart with talk of the stars. There's not the smallest orb which thou behold'st, but in his motion like an angel sings, still choiring to the young-eyed cherubins. Such harmony is in immortal souls. This is the music of the spheres, the idea that the stars and planets, as they travel through space, make beautiful music together. The music of the spheres played out of the ancient classical world through the medieval period and into the Renaissance. It affords us a glimpse into minds for whom the universe is full of meaning, of strange correspondences and grand harmonies.
I think general education, among the many other masters it serves, ought to be serving the cause of bringing our students into a universe full of meaning. Because if we didn't believe there was any meaning, what would we be teaching? A universe full of strange correspondences and grand harmonies. And I want to hope that the muddy vesture of schooling, credit hours, GPAs, and requirements does not so grossly close our ears that we cannot hear those strange correspondences and grand harmonies. I believe that the information and communication technologies in the midst of this grand revolution we're living through, the very beginning of, have a chance, if we learn to use them well, just as with the alphabet, of actually bringing us into a larger sense of these strange correspondences and grand harmonies. This, by the way, is an audio excerpt from a podcast from the BBC, which I listen to on my iPod while I'm driving. It's okay, I can concentrate, believe me. This is a screenshot from the website. You get the idea. The very idea I'm sharing with you now comes from a chain of information and communication technologies that, I think, used well, brings us into something closer to hearing this music. So I typically get questions about this, and I don't want to forestall the Q&A, but here at the peroration, I guess we'd call it, one question I typically get is, how do you do this and cover content? This all sounds very grand. And I am going to go through some of the step-by-step ways I actually do some of these things in the workshops. But as an overview, although I would like to move away from the idea of covering content, I understand that domain knowledge is important. I'm a Miltonist, so I'm all about the books, too. But one way to think about this is to bring our students' ideas into a fuller socialization with each other. This is a coffee house, which was the internet of the 18th century. First of all, they'd stop drinking all day, which meant they were more alert. They were on a cognitive stimulant now, coffee. And they were all together in a room talking about stuff they were excited about. Home of the scientific revolution. It doesn't proceed from confusion to light bulb to clarity, or from thesis and antithesis to synthesis, pace Hegel. It's a network. The internet is a coffee house, or can be, if we can figure out ways to make those communications channels help our students help their own ideas to socialize, to form networks with each other. This is from a book I also highly recommend. It's called The Invention of Air. And it's by Stephen Johnson. It's about Joseph Priestley. And it's just a whacking good tale. It's really quite an amazing story. And Johnson tells it very well. But it's also a story about education and about what Johnson calls the socialization of ideas. It turns out that Priestley was addicted to sharing stuff. So like many of the early scientists, he was always sending these letters out, and he was in this constant communication, sharing these ideas, building on what other people had done. The other thing that Johnson tells us Priestley did was write down every idea as it came to him, half-baked, a hunch, didn't matter. If Priestley were living today, I think he would be a blogger. What is this integration going to look like? What will these communications channels look like? They're probably not going to look like term papers. They're probably not going to look like reading quizzes. Those may be good things that we need to continue. My students will be writing term papers in my class this semester. But sometimes they're going to look like Little Big Planet. Do you know what Little Big Planet is? Okay. That's good. If you did, there'd be no reason for me to be here. I would sit down. Little Big Planet is a game for the Sony PlayStation 3. It also is one of the platforms named by the United States Department of Education as a development platform to increase science, technology, engineering, and mathematics capabilities, education in the schools, and K-12 as well as college. It's a cross between a Renaissance fair, Monty Python, Sesame Street, and Kukla, Fran, and Ollie, for those of you who might be as old as I am. Why does that matter? The game is a couple of years old, maybe 2.5 years now. In July of 2009, 1 million user-created levels had been uploaded to the servers of the parent company. Oh, this is a game which has built into it tools for building more levels to the game. Oh, so you play the game, and when you get to the end of the game, you make more of the game. But then you upload the more of the game you have made and share it with everyone else around the world. You can rate it. You can search by rating or by author. You can tag it. Interesting, goofy, unique, intriguing, etc. This is a massive global ecosystem of integrative learning. February 2010, we're now up to 2 million user-created levels for something that you can buy for $60 at Best Buy and play on a PS3. Who knew? Well, now we know. Let's say that 95% of those 2 million levels are junk. You still can't get through all the great stuff that people are creating for nothing other than the pleasure of creating something interesting. And if you want to see some samples, go to YouTube and search on Little Big Planet levels. And what you'll see are movies people have made of the levels they have created, which range from playing music on these levels to physics and engineering demonstrations to just goofy stuff, fun stuff. Hang on to the roller coaster and look how weird it's going to be. Very interesting things. 95% of it may be junk. This leaves, what, 200,000 to get through? How's my math? Was that okay? Is that wrong? If it's 95%, it'd be 100,000, right? Good. It may look like this, this integrative learning that these communication technologies may enable. That, again, is an iPhone. It's my iPhone. And the photograph is not as good as it could be, but I'll tell you what you're seeing in the background because, all right. I didn't grow up in the 60s. I was only 12 when Woodstock happened, but I wish I had been there. That's the Jefferson Airplane House in San Francisco. 2400 Fulton Street. Feed your head. Okay, right. And that's an application called Wikitude that runs on an iPhone that allows users to create content related to points of interest in that area that anyone else coming along with that app can pick up on. So what if students did that using this network of geolocation, mobile computing, and what they've had to learn? To create material relevant to points of interest wherever they go. That could be interesting. Unless they come into our classrooms and there are no points of interest there, that would be discouraging. It may look like this. This is Jean-Claude Bradley at Drexel University, a pioneering practitioner of open notebook science, which is a back-to-the-future experiment. All science initially was open notebook. That's how scientific innovation is communicated. Scientists put their data out there. Well, Jean-Claude had the idea, what if we have students in introductory science labs put their data out there on the web? Good, bad, and ugly. Just put it out there. Why? Now it becomes socialized. Now many eyes can participate in the vetting of this data. And what he's ended up being able to do with this project is to do all of his direct instruction online before students ever come to class. Class then, even at the intro level, especially at the intro level, becomes extended lab hours. And he walks from student to student and works with them on whatever they're stuck on instead of going over the material. It may look like Second Life. Anybody been into Second Life here? Okay, good. Second Life is a persistent virtual world. Like the real world, there's a lot of it devoted to sex and gambling. Like the real world, if you don't want to go there, don't go there. Okay. In Second Life, the entire world is built. It turns out to be a very interesting way to simulate things. Things that you would like to simulate, like surgery, or going inside a heart, or things that you can't get to easily, like the Sistine Chapel. Take a look at Vassar's replication of the Sistine Chapel. You can actually fly around in Second Life, inside the Sistine Chapel, and get a completely different perspective, a kind of Michelangelo's eye view of the way those images would have looked to him as he painted them. And you can share it, and I could meet my class in the virtual Sistine Chapel this afternoon in Lyle while they're back in Waco. I've actually done that, not from Lyle to Waco, but from Barcelona to Waco, and it worked okay. Or it may look like this. I'm going to be talking more about this later today. This is a little thing I've wired together out of RSS feeds and various kinds of online affordances that I call a mother blog. I borrow that term from Barbara Ganley, who has been extremely influential for me, and I thank her for that. Essentially, this is a kind of republication space or a digital dashboard for my students' activity online during and in between class meetings. So, in the middle are republications of what they're blogging in their own blog spaces in between class meetings. On the left is a feed that I get from Delicious, a social bookmarking site, where I urge them with their laptops during class to go out and grab things from the web relevant to what we're talking about, tag them, which means assigning a particular keyword. In this case, it's like the hashtag for Twitter that then routes it to a feed, which then republishes it on this digital dashboard. I republish all their comments on each other's blogs. And then here is a one-stop shop where we can see what I like to call the course writing itself into being. It's also great for me because I can see things they're thinking about and interested in, and I can lead class with that. So I walk in, and the first thing I do is start talking about what they're thinking about with regard to the course, which I can see because it's up on their own spaces. And each of them in a space like this has their own individual blog, which may look nothing like this. They can customize it. So as a final example of integrative learning, here's what happened last fall. A first-year seminar. All the students are blogging. All the students are saving bookmarks relevant to the course to Delicious. All the students are using Twitter as a back channel during class to be able to speak with each other without disrupting the discussion, to be able to interact with a librarian who's following from her office and intervening just in time. Oh, you're interested in dreams? Here's the Encyclopedia of Dreams, etc. Directing them to the library, where she's no longer the librarian. She's our librarian, which was very nice for her and wonderful for me. The students are all creating this content flowing out of and into the course. And one day, TJ blogs this. My rhetoric professor today used an interesting analogy to link the play Antigone to modern culture. Already, we're where general ed wants to be. We're at that generalization. We're making those connections. He was going to make that connection anyway, but now he's blogged about it, which connects it with everyone else in the class, connects it with me. I see the connection has been made. This spurs me to more thinking. And the interesting analogy was the oracle at Delphi is the same as this meta medium, Google. So his rhetoric professor is and if you've ever searched on something really weird, you'll know it's about as enigmatic as the oracle. If you want to do something really fun and you got your laptops open now, Google the word recursion, R-E-C-U-R-S-I-O-N, and you'll just have a little fun moment. If you're like me, you may rub your eyes a couple times. Just keep doing it. So TJ makes a connection, republishes the connection. It connects with me. It's between rhetoric, a first-year seminar, Miltonist gone astray, teaching new media studies, connecting the Oracle at Delphi with Google, connecting all of that with all of his classes, his classmates, potentially the entire world, because periodically I'll ping my network and ask them, leave a comment on my student's blog. Just come on in. Just leave a comment. So they'll get comments potentially from anywhere in the world. His classmates comment on his post. Eric says, great analogy. I never thought of an oracle that way. This didn't come up in the class discussion. It would have been fine if it had, but you know how quickly that time goes. But it did come up. Eric did see it. Librarian Ellen saw it. Trevor saw it. Stephen Reed saw it. Who is Stephen Reed? Stephen Reed says the analysis is interesting. You might read Jeff Jarvis's new book, What Would Google Do? Now he misspelled Google. You got to get past it. It's a typo. This stuff happens pretty quickly, right? Doesn't mean it's not valuable. You have sparked some interesting ideas. I hope you continue to work on them. Steve. So we have a first-year seminar with a new media studies professor interacting with a rhetoric professor, whom I've never met, I hope to, interacting with all the classes, connecting all around the campus, potentially connecting with the world. Steve is a professor of Hebrew Scriptures at Truett Seminary. WWGD, what would Google do? Biblical jazz. That's a ping back or a track back. In addition to leaving a comment, Steve blogged about it. This is my colleague Steve Reed's blog, Biblical Jazz. In his blog entry, he linked to my student's post on the Oracle at Delphi and Google and rhetoric and new media studies and blog, and you get the idea, right? We're in a network effect here that has no necessary stopping point, like an education. But the beautiful part is that I can see it. They can see it. Seeing it, they can believe in it, and it's something more than a GPA and a diploma. This is a process of narrating. It's a process of curating, deciding what to present and how, and it's a process of sharing. And these things are most powerful when they employ network effects, which is what happens when it's out on the open web. And in this thing we call Web 2.0, which I'll talk about later today, we've got either cheap or free ways to do this at staggering scale with some unintended consequences, some of which are wonderful. No longer does it have to be a feedlot. No longer does it have to be an assembly line. No longer does it have to be a whipping. And if you want some really grim news along those lines, read Tim Clydesdale's The First Year Out. Clydesdale is a sociologist who studied 4 or 5 years ago the passage from the last year of high school to the first year of college. And he found that students essentially made themselves impervious to transformation in that first year because they were simply trying to learn the skills of life management. But I think there's something beyond that they could also be experiencing if they didn't think of it as a liberal arts hazing. It's a paradigm shift from a habit trail to a habitat. And I'll let Janet Murray have the last word. The task is the same now as it ever has been. Familiar, thrilling, unavoidable. We work with all our myriad talents to expand our media of expression to the full measure of our humanity. And this is why I think these information and communication technologies matter. So thanks for your attention. I'll be happy to take any questions that you have. I know we're looking at a hard deadline of having to clear out for the next class, but be happy to entertain any questions. Yes?
How do you move from the media class to your local seminar where you work really closely?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have a whole set of screenshots from another presentation where I show how I use this in my Milton seminar. Essentially, it starts with blogging, which is an informal but highly purposeful mode of public reflection. If they are not reading closely, their reflection will be obviously superficial and poor. That will matter more to them if they see the reflections that are rich and engaged. The thing about blogging and all of these kind of public online activities, they tend to erase the back of the class. If you're going to make a decision to be superficial and disengaged, you have to do that in front of everybody. And it also means that the people, and we always have these in our classes, thank goodness, who come in ready to grab it and growl, their work is also immediately available as an example and sets a certain standard. So what I had my students do in the seminar, I had them reflect twice weekly in the blog. I told them, don't think of this as an assignment, it's a requirement. The difference is you're not punching a clock. Don't blog twice on Sunday to make up for it. You can't make up for a conversation. It happens now. Blog these things, reflect on what it is you're reading, and because it's a creative space, it's actually liberatory for them. They can bring in images. They can bring in sounds. They can link to other blogs. They can link, and I'm lucky with Milton, a lot of the stuff's in the public domain. They're able to link out to those things. But anything that has a link, you can link to, a library book, an article. If it's behind a paywall, you can still get to it inside the campus. I also had them bookmark things to Delicious that were relevant. It's not just my bias, but everything is relevant to Milton. That's completely objective. And they got creative with that. And wouldn't you know it, someone found my blog about one of my classes and then went over and linked to one of the students' blogs. And that became a way for them to see that, oh, this is kind of interesting to people outside the course. So it actually fed into the same kind of sustained reading that you would want in any class. So it isn't just that you have to teach a class in new media to use new media to great effect. Same sort of thing happens in other classes. Yes, the question is, what do I do when students run into trouble with the technology? And by using it inappropriately, you don't mean using swear words on their blogs. You mean they run into snags. Yeah. I have to take that on a kind of case-by-case and year-by-year basis, depending on what the questions are. My typical strategy is to say, I understand you're having problems uploading a document. I see that Jane or Jack has mastered that well. Could the two of you confer after class? I bet you can pick it up pretty quickly. If a student has a huge block about it, I'll just schedule an office visit and we'll figure it out. What's interesting is that they they will have trouble with something like Blackboard, for instance. And this will be something that is just very frustrating and blocks them. They may have the same problem with a blog, but because it's theirs and they've customized it and they'd like it to look cool, it functions as a very great intrinsic motivator. And it's amazing, if they Google a couple of times, the community of support for these open web types of things is huge. So somebody will have had that basic question, and they can usually figure it out pretty quickly. So I won't say that that's never a problem. It is a problem that's going away very quickly, but it's also a problem that can be handled in a much larger community of support than just what I tell them. They can get it from their classmates. They can get it out on the open web.
I'm wondering how you deal with issues of active honesty and plagiarism, because it seems to be one of the risks of this kind of model is that in some ways it imagines an ideal kind of student, right? That it all students say, hey, I'm making my own blog, I'm going to produce my own stuff. But let's face it, we have a lot of students who are in our classes because they have to be in classes because they're just jumping through the group and they're looking for the shortest way out on getting work. How do you prevent them, first of all, like buying in, or how do you get them, first of all, to buy into the intellectual project? But then how do you also get them to not see the internet as a kind of intellectual buffet, which they can take from without self-generating content, which I think is not what you're advocating?
Absolutely, I am. Well, that's a great question. Did everybody hear the question back in the back? Okay. Let me try to take it step by step. First of all, I am imagining an ideal student. And I do that really deliberately, and I do it over and over, and I do it with a ferocity that I hope pins their ears back in the front row. I simply imagine that my students are all ideal students, and I try to make that something that they can't avoid knowing that I'm imagining. So there's value in that. I do not give them prompts. Very rarely will I even suggest that they blog about something specific. I will say it needs to be relevant to the course. And if they say, what's relevant to the course? We have a conversation about that, in which I try not to tell them what to do, at the same time guiding them towards an understanding that they can't be blogging about their soccer team and have that be relevant. But they know that. They're not going to be silly like that. What I don't do is say, today we will all blog about the role of Eve in Book 5 of Paradise Lost. Because as soon as I do that, they will write a term paper and post it to their blogs, which I do not want them to do. And if they write a term paper and they're doing it the night before, they're going to go find something on the internet that they can plug in. So the way I get them not to do that is by making it clear that this is not an opportunity to post term papers to their blogs. So how would I detect plagiarism? First of all, I can Google the way they can. So if suddenly there's a paragraph there that looks like Northrop Frye wrote it, I can find that. But it may have happened and gotten by me, but I don't think so. Because when they finally, and they have to trust me on this, that's the thing that's most important. When they finally figure out that I really want them to write in their own voices about what they're thinking, they would like to do that. They actually enjoy doing that. But this is really important, so I want to try to make this as vivid as possible. They get engaged with the idea of doing this because to them it looks like they're just saying what they think. Well, in fact, that's what they're doing. They're saying what they think. But they are thinking, and they're thinking in a kind of interaction with each other that causes a certain, it's almost self-shaping. Not entirely. If it were entirely self-shaping, they could just go be the internet and they wouldn't need me. But it feels so self-originated to them, and largely is, that they're not going out and Googling what Northrop Frye said about Eve in Book 5. They're trying to work through it, and they know that I'm going to come in and say, what a great insight. And if it's not their insight, and they're not ashamed to own it as their insight, even though it isn't, then trying to lock it down is not going to solve that problem. That's a much, much more basic problem. So I try to make it something that reflects authentic engagement, authentic thinking from them. Try to make it not be a term paper that they're posting to the web. And encourage them to be informal but not sloppy. And they usually get the hang of that pretty quickly. Thank you all very much. I hope to see some of you later today. Thank you.